Becca, where are we right now and what are we listening to?
We're in Columbus, Georgia.
I was glad when they said unto me,
at a Baptist church,
let us go into the house of the Lord. Our feet shall stand within thy gates, O Jerusalem.
I am standing out here on this gray day next to sort of this makeshift pulpit where there is a band set up, and in front of me I see so many cars.
Give the pastor a great big round of applause.
Reverend Raphael Warnock is preaching here this Sunday.
It's wonderful to be here. I'm running as a person of faith, shaped by our churches. I grew up in the church. I was born in the church. And all of that has shaped me into the person that I have become.
I wanted to find out how people outside of Atlanta are receiving Reverend Warnock, and I wanted to get a better feel for what people think of him in the more like rural parts of Georgia.
It's dark. But if you hold on for just a little while, the sun begins to break through the clouds and you discover that morning is here after all.
And if there was one thing that stayed with you after this sermon, what was it?
But joy comes in the morning.
I think it was just the power of faith and the role that takes in political organizing. I think this is particularly key to Reverend Warnock's campaign, a legacy of organizing, particularly civil rights organizing within the Black church. And I just found that spirit of social justice and of a commitment to progress and equality to be really powerful.
And we'll talk all about that.
And all of this we will do to the glory of God. God bless you. Thank you so very much.
This is the Mother Jones Podcast. I'm Jamila King in Brooklyn. On today's show, faith in the race. On last week's show, you heard all about the huge importance of the Georgia runoffs on January 5th next year. Control of the U.S. Senate is at stake. This week, we're actually taking you there. We're going behind the scenes of Reverend Raphael Warnock's Senate run. Warnock's faith and his ties to the civil rights movement is rallying his supporters. And being attacked by his Republican opponents in all the tired old racist ways. We take you along for the ride through the barnstorming, sermon-flinging final weeks of this race. Politics in the pulpit. Stick around. Mother Jones reporter Becca Andrews is on the ground right now, and she's joining us. Becca, how's it going?
Can't complain. How are you, Jamila?
I'm hanging in there. So, Becca, what was your first stop in Georgia?
So my first stop was in Athens, Georgia, which is probably best known as the home of the University of Georgia. And there are all of these students who have come out to support Reverend Warnock. They're politically motivated, they're eloquent, they're excited to be there. And one after another, they're climbing up into the bed of this pickup truck to express their support for Warnock before he speaks. It's the first time that I'd gotten to see this energy on the ground. I wrote a profile of Reverend Warnock that was in Mother Jones a few months ago, but this was my first time really seeing what that looks like in Georgia. So Augusta, Georgia was where the campaign stopped on Friday evening.
Hello, East Augusta!
It's the first time I've ever been to a drive-in political rally. The vibe is quite different, but still really energetic.
You're sending a message loud and clear that Georgia is in play.
You know, lots of loud music, and folks were, you know, sort of coming out of their cars to see Reverend Warnock and to hear him speak.
And the future of our children.
Yes!
Yeah.
All of our children.
Yes.
Red, yellow, brown, black, and white, they're all precious in God's sight.
In Augusta, I spoke with the Reverend Christopher Johnson,
executive director and chairman of the Great Augusta Interfaith Coalition, which comprised of 19 counties in the state of Georgia, on the east side of Georgia. And I'm also happen to be the 12th congressional district chairman of the Democratic Party of Georgia.
And we had this really great conversation about, you know, the history of organizing in Georgia and how Reverend Warnock fits into this legacy.
We come out of the tradition also believing that, you know, we first of all, servant of all. And we also believe in transcending, you know, changing what is to what we believe it ought to be.
You know, Reverend Johnson is one of those people who really believes in spreading the gospel. And he sees politics as a way to continue that work. So he quoted John Wesley to me a couple of times saying that every interaction, right, is an opportunity to do good in the world and to spread, you know, what they would call the good word.
You help get the message out to people that need to be encouraged. You help get the message out to people that need to know that there's another side of the story. You help get the message out to people that just needed a pat on the back to say, yes, somebody recognized what we're about. But I'm like a John Wesley. I believe that the whole world is my parish. So, yes, I've been in Kikawe again. What affect one neighbor affect all of us. And I've been, I honestly believe that, you know, I could have put my gifts and talent to some lazy, being a billionaire or whatever, but I put my gifts and talent and try to make the world a better place.
So he sees Reverend Warnock's candidacy as more of that and a big step forward for folks who have traditionally not been empowered in Georgia and in the South.
And it's interesting. We think of Georgia flipping blue as new, but Johnson and Warnock represent a decades-old movement here. Is that right?
Absolutely. I mean, the history of organizing in the South and in Georgia in particular is so rich, and it stretches back to before the Civil Rights Movement. You know, what we're really seeing in Georgia with it turning blue is the fruit of labor that has been developing for many, many, many years.
What was it like talking to Reverend Johnson? He sounds really nice and welcoming.
He was really sweet. The thing that I love the most about reporting in the South is that you meet somebody and then automatically they want to introduce you to a bunch of other people. So, you know, he was taking me around and helping me meet folks in Augusta, and was just very eager to tell his story and to show me around. Very, very warm.
So you're there following Warnock's campaign. What was your sense of how closely the energy around his campaign is tied to this deep history of religion and religious organizing?
I mean, it's very tangible. You know, there's a prayer at almost every single rally. There are people singing hymns. You know, it's a huge part of his identity. It's a huge part of who he is. He uses a lot of sort of traditional, like, call and response in his speeches. So he has this anecdote about how his daddy would tell him to get up early in the morning and get his shoes on and get ready to go.
He's on the way. Put your shoes on and get ready.
Even if he didn't have anywhere specific to go, like, it was, you know, 7 a.m. on a Saturday, like, boy, get up, get your shoes on. And he would sort of turn it into this call and response with the folks in the audience. And there are a lot of little moments like that throughout his rallies that I found to be particularly compelling.
Kelly Loeffler and the whole Republican apparatus seem to be really targeting Warnock. What negative tropes or stereotypes is she hoping that attack unleashes?
Well, so if you look back at the debate between Loeffler and Warnock, she sort of took on this almost robotic persona where she was repeating every time she said his name, you know, radical liberal Raphael Warnock.
My opponent, radical liberal Raphael Warnock. Radical liberal Raphael Warnock. Radical liberal Raphael Warnock. Radical liberal Raphael Warnock. My opponent,
and the contrast of that with the way that he addressed her, he would always address her as senator, was pretty striking. And I certainly felt like the tone that she was using with him was weighted in a way that I bristled at.
Raphael Warnock. Radical liberal Raphael Warnock. Radical liberal Raphael Warnock.
Becca, that kind of reminds me of, you know, this thing, this legacy in the South where, you know, white folks would call black people by their first names or, you know, with very little respect. And black people in turn were expected to always address, you know, white folks respectfully with Mr. or Mrs. or Doctor. Am I right there, or is that just like me putting too much on this?
I think you see her often trying to delegitimize his faith. She often will attack him for being a pastor who is also pro-choice. Her claim is that you can't be Christian and be pro-choice, though Reverend Warnock certainly is. And there is actually a pretty amazing history of religious people advocating for women's rights and women's reproductive autonomy. It's very Trumpian, but it's also very racially loaded.
Is it working?
That's a good question. I'm not sure. I mean, it certainly seems like Republicans in Georgia, for the most part, sort of fall in line with it. But I also don't think that we should discount those Republicans here who have felt really alienated by Trump and who have been really alienated by the turn that the Republican Party has taken over the past 4 or 5 years.
So, Becca, you are a Southerner who was raised in the church, and a lot of your reporting over the past several years has dealt with sort of the nexus between political organizing and people of faith. So now you're kind of seeing this play out on a national scale in a way that it really hasn't in recent memory. What's that been like to witness?
Yeah, it's sort of flipped. You know, I feel like usually when I'm covering faith and politics, I'm often covering it in the context of the ways that faith is used to oppress other people and the way that it's used to justify the mistreatment of those who are generally not white or cisgender or heterosexual. So it's been really fun, frankly, to cover a campaign that is really flipping that on its head and looking at faith and social justice as two things that go hand in hand, which obviously is not anything that's new, right? Like that's something that's been alive and well in Southern churches, and particularly in the Black church, for decades. But it has been really interesting to see it grow to this extent.
Becca, where are we off to after the break? Where next on the adventure?
Next, we'll go to Albany, Georgia, which is maybe best known for its massive coronavirus outbreak earlier this year that cost the lives of many people. I was curious to go there to see how that loss has impacted the community and how they're working through the trauma and whether or not that will affect turnout.
Becca Andrews is a Mother Jones reporter who's covering the runoff election from up close, but still at a distance, wearing a mask. Hey, it's really easy to support the Mother Jones podcast. All you've got to do is subscribe. That really helps us out. It helps the platforms that we're on get us to new ears and new listeners. So go ahead and hit that subscribe button. Thanks.
The Mother Jones stories you're hearing right now are brought to you by our listeners and loyal readers who fuel our work. Audience support makes up 2/3 of the Mother Jones budget and helps our team dig deep on stories that matter. Make a donation at motherjones.com/give to keep our nonprofit newsroom humming. Again, that's motherjones.com/give.
Welcome back to the show. We're here with Mother Jones reporter Becca Andrews, who joins us from Georgia. She's been at drive-in rallies, at churches, and following the campaign. Becca, Black churches have a long history of civil rights activism, political organizing, and expanding the vote. But what happened this year in Georgia was different. Georgia voted for a Democrat for president for the fourth time in 60 years. So it can't just be about the civil rights movement, right? Like, what else has changed?
Sure. I mean, I think Trump has changed the dynamic, right? I think Donald Trump has alienated a lot of voters who normally would have been sort of shoo-ins for the Republican Party, and I think that's part of it. But I also think that when 2016 happened, it motivated a lot of people to really get involved and to really get into politics, young people in particular. So some of the folks that I talked to in Albany, Georgia, you know, have been organizing for forever, but, you know, maybe we're drawn to it in a different way now. So, for example, I talked to this young woman named Amna Faruqi. I'm a community organizer with 9 to 5 Georgia. She grew up in Virginia near DC.
I moved to Georgia after Trump won to work on the Ossoff campaign.
And she was telling me about how she just wanted to move somewhere in the rural South and start organizing. And
I asked folks, where do people not go? And they said Southwest Georgia. So I came to Southwest Georgia and didn't think I'd stay here this long, but I've gotten very attached.
Now she lives in Albany, Georgia, and, you know, works for progressive causes and works to create a more equal society. And she's developed this really amazing heart for the South and for the rural South in general.
Everything amazing and resilient and real is here. And I really feel like the country is struggling with all these like big questions right now. The answers are through rural Southern communities. I really feel that. And people here have been struggling with them for much longer. And so now when you talk about like energy crisis, climate crisis, Albany has seen hurricanes and tornadoes and floods for a long time. And people here pay more in their light bill than they do in their rent, you know, and the poverty here is high. That just like the energy and around organizing here is so deep, and the legacy of organizing here is quite deep too. And so that's why I love Southwest Georgia.
Amna talked a lot about what things have been like in Albany since coronavirus hit that community particularly hard. Some of our listeners may remember national stories about a funeral in Albany, Georgia that turned out to be a super spreader event and infected a pretty large swath of the population in Albany. A lot of people died. Amna talked about healthcare being a particular issue, and so did Warnock at his rally.
I feel like when he speaks about like rural hospitals closing, and he talks about like, you know, the importance of just seeing people and their humanity and like pre-existing conditions and that kind of stuff. I feel like that messaging really resonates with a lot of people, especially considering we were a hotspot during COVID and what people are and still are going through.
She talked about Georgia's failure to expand Medicaid and the way that literally results in loss of life in Georgia, and how it's also resulted in the closure of many rural hospitals so that, you know, if someone gets really sick, for example, from coronavirus, that means they have a longer journey ahead of them to try to get the care that they need. And, you know, when you're having a medical emergency, time is of the essence.
Who are some of the other young organizers you talked to in Albany?
I talked to Kiana Jackson.
I am a freshman grad student at Johns Hopkins University, and I am the regional coordinator for Black Voters Matter down here in Southwest Georgia.
She was born in Albany, spent there her whole life.
Yes, I was born and raised here all 23 years of my life, haven't left yet. Finally leaving in May. I'm moving to Maryland for school, so.
And she talked about how it's going to be kind of hard to leave the South and leave this place that she's invested so much in as a community organizer.
Yeah, this is home. I always tell people, it's something about Albany, and we are literally one big family, and you just don't get that in a lot of communities. And that's what makes organizing down here in Albany so beautiful, is that the community swarms you. with love, with support.
It's really incredible to me, particularly as someone who grew up in the rural South, hearing people talk about, you know, just like the vibrant dynamics that exist there and the ways that organizing has continued to grow there and become even more influential and important.
And then Albany was literally the basis for the Birmingham movement for Dr. Martin Luther King. He came here first. And he saw the slights that he had. He saw the issues that certain communities had. And when he went to Birmingham, he was able to build a better coalition, to have a better blueprint for how he was going to organize. And that's why he was so successful in Alabama, was because of the work that he did here in Albany. And we, even our own hometown heroes like Charles Sherrod, Shirley Sherrod, people who have been constantly pushing the needle, that's here. That's the spirit of the people in Albany. And so we're just happy that the nation is starting to see what we've seen our entire lives.
So on last week's show, we dug into voter suppression in Georgia. Our senior reporter, Mother Jones, Ari Berman, kind of walked us through how Stacey Abrams losing the race for governor a couple years ago, and there being, you know, lots of allegations of voter suppression, sort of galvanized people this time around.
Georgia was really the epicenter of voter suppression in 2018. Stacey Abrams was running to become the first Black woman governor in U.S. history, and her opponent, Brian Kemp, was both the Secretary of State and a candidate for governor. And Republicans instituted a whole series of policies that made it harder for Abrams and her coalition to be able to vote. And they committed themselves to organizing against voter suppression for 2 years. And Stacey, in a very high-profile move, formed her own voting rights group. They really devoted themselves to trying to create the kind of electorate in 2020 that Abrams envisioned in 2018. And that was the electorate that turned out for Joe Biden in November.
Do you see any of that?
Yeah, I think that's completely spot on. But I think there's also still a lot of fear and a lot of anxiety in Georgia over voter suppression. You know, some of the people that I talked to in more rural parts of the state were really worried about, for example, their mail-in ballots. You know, they were like asking me if I thought it was going to be okay and if I thought their votes were going to be counted. And of course, like, hearing that fear and seeing it is also motivating for activists, too, who are like, no, like, everyone's vote should count. This really matters. What can we do to make sure that everyone's vote counts?
We have to make sure that we got to vote, because we know that voting is the most responsible civic duty and one of the most important civic duties that we have as a people. And it's such a hard fought for right. We've always known that Georgia is, at its heart, ready for progress. We're ready to be different. And the only reason why we have been able to is because of the massive amounts of efforts that are being pushed to suppress the vote of people of color and of young people.
Were there any other races that these organizers cared about other than the Senate run?
Yes. So Kiana in particular talked a lot about the upcoming race for public service commissioner in Albany. And that is a really important race because the public service commissioner has a lot of influence.
Public service commissioner, especially for rural communities, because we have a utilities crisis. And so we are driving home. Yes, the Senate race is important, but that public service commissioner seat is so impactful for rural communities in Georgia that are suffering from utilities crisis. We have people whose light bills are 2 times higher than their rent. And that is not a one-time instance. That is a normal occurrence down here in the South and in rural communities. And so we are really pushing people to pay attention to that public service commissioner race.
That's a race that originally was also scheduled to be separate from the Senate runoff, which would have meant, you know, a whole other election for folks to have to go out to the polls to vote for. It was a really big deal for them to finally get like both of those races consolidated on the ballot together for January 5th.
Did you get a sense from these organizers about whether they're optimistic that more progressive candidates can win in Georgia?
I think they're very optimistic. So another person that I met at the drive-in rally in Albany was Demetrius Young. He is commissioner for Ward 6 in Albany. And he's another one of these sort of like young and up-and-coming political figures in Albany who just, you know, clearly really loves the community and clearly wants to work to make things better there.
You know, we do have some progressive genes here in Georgia. I know you may not remember, but you know, Jimmy Carter, you know, is probably one of the ultimate progressives, and he grew up right here in South Georgia, less than an hour away from Albany. So we really just feel like it's time for that change, and we can be a part of that change. We just need to make everyone in rural Georgia, you know, feel like they matter and that their votes count.
Is there anything else that stuck with you from all of the conversations out on this socially distanced campaign trail?
It was really interesting to see what a political campaign looks like in the context of a pandemic, right? Like, it really didn't seem to discourage people. It didn't really seem to dampen the energy at all. People were still out. They still, you know, wanted to be together. They still wanted to hear their candidate speak. And they still seemed really dedicated to democracy. You know, I think with everything that's happened this year, in a way, that's a really beautiful thing.
Becca Andrews, thank you so much for joining the show from Georgia. Where can we find more of your reporting?
Thanks for having me. You can find it at www.motherjones.com.
Thanks so much, Becca.
Thanks, Jamila.
Hi. My name is Abigail Weinberg, and I'm a senior fellow in the New York City office. Right now, I'm working on a story about what it will mean for Americans when Congress's stimulus aid expires at the end of the year. Here are the credits for today's show. Theme music for the Mother Jones podcast was composed by Micah Barrick at Hear Film. This week's episode was reported by Becca Andrews. It was produced by James West, our executive producer, and Molly Schwartz, our associate producer. James West did the mixing and the mastering, with additional production by Mark Kalinowski and Jamila King. And credit where credit is due, Mother Jones is supported by you, our listeners and readers. So thanks.
That's it this week for the Mother Jones podcast. Look, we love bringing you these stories each and every week. And if you want to support us in doing that, then it's really simple. Just hit the subscribe button. It really helps new listeners find us. I'm your host, Jamila King, in Brooklyn. I'll see you next week. This podcast is brought to you by Mother Jones listeners, like you, who donate to keep our newsroom buzzing. Help us stay on the beat. Go to motherjones.com/give.